Illinois Public Media. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Abraham Lincoln may be the most well-documented person in American history. There are tens of thousands of books that go deep on the major chapters in his life, from his humble birth and upbringing in Kentucky and Indiana, to his law practice in Springfield, and his remarkable rise to the presidency of the United States. We also know a million more obscure facts, like about his success as a wrestler and that he was the first president to wear a beard. It seems that nearly 159 years after Lincoln's assassination, there might not be much left to learn, or at least not many new sources from which to learn it. And yet, we've recently learned of the existence of an order Lincoln signed 4 days before his murder. It's shedding some additional light on what he was doing and thinking about during his last week as president. The note is currently for sale through the Rab Collection for the low, low price of $45,000. Joining me now is Nathan Rab, president of the collection and the second generation in this family business. Nathan, welcome to the 21st Show.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
We're also joined by Daniel Worthington, director of the Papers of Abraham Lincoln, which is part of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield. Daniel, welcome to the 21st Show to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you are also welcome to join us as ever at 800-222-9455. Do you think you might have a Lincoln letter lurking somewhere in your house? You can let us know about it at 800-222-9455. All right, Nathan, let's talk about this. How did this letter come to be in your collection?
So we get approached by people every day who have found something, whether it's something that they inherited or something that they stumbled across in any number of places, all over the country and the world. And that was the case here, where an elderly woman from the Midwest had been looking through a desk that had belonged to her now deceased husband. He died more than a decade ago. And she found something that he cherished enough to keep by his side, this document signed by Abraham Lincoln. How does it find its way to us? Well, sometimes it's as simple as an email or a phone call. In this case, the woman wanted to come meet with us, understand better what it is that she had. And when she walked in the door of our office in suburban Philadelphia, she was holding this piece of paper, which no one had seen in decades, and that had been signed by Abraham Lincoln just days before he had died. Just a remarkable memento of what Lincoln was doing in his final hours.
Talk about your process. You must get approached, as you said, all the time. I imagine that not all of them are authentic. Maybe, you know, there's a little antiques roadshow swirling in people's minds. What process do you have for evaluating these approaches?
Well, I think you've stumbled across one of the more exciting aspects of our job, because I have no idea what's going to walk in the door, and I mean door, email, call, or literal door, any day. I wake up every day with new hope that some great historical treasure will cross our path. The reality is that for every 100 pieces that do cross our path, we try to acquire maybe one. And the reason is not what you would think. It's not like people are out there trying to trick us or deceive us. Some people, of course, do have forgeries, and they do find our way to us. But the majority of people have things that we would consider not historically important or not appropriate for us. So whether it's Lincoln, Washington, Jefferson, Napoleon, Churchill, we're looking for the things that tell us a little bit more about the person and his or her life. But the Antiques Roadshow element is one of the great excitements of it, because, you know, it also gives us an opportunity to learn as we find these documents. So we find a document, something crosses our path, and then I get to learn all about what's going on for that person in that moment around the document itself.
So interest in a Lincoln letter, maybe not so much if it was the, you know, deputy treasury secretary during the Cleveland administration or something like that.
Well, I think that's fair. There are certainly examples where that letter of that obscure person, who I can't name that person, maybe you can. I'd be super impressed if you could.
No.
There certainly would be examples in which that would be an interesting and important document, a primary resource for scholars. I don't think the market would pay a lot for it, because as we've just identified, neither one of us knows who that person is.
All right, Daniel Worthington, let me bring you to the conversation now with the Papers of Abraham Lincoln. How common is it for a document like this, and not just Lincoln, but any former president or other politician, to be in the hands of a private citizen locked in a desk drawer?
Well, it's fairly common. We get a lot of people, and we've received a lot of letters and scanned a lot of particularly military commissions that are in private hands. And we, a lot of people have their ancestor or their, most of the military officers have their, have the original commission that Lincoln signed and that's on their wall. And oftentimes they will contact the papers of Abraham Lincoln and say, hey, you know, we've got this commission. And sometimes they want us to authenticate if that's a Lincoln signature. And we can, of course, we can authenticate if it's a Lincoln signature. And oftentimes they will provide us a scan of that document. So yeah, this is fairly common with military commissions. Now, I have not in my tenure as the director seen a document like this one, where it's a non-military appointment. Normally we, that's in the, and then that's in private hands. Normally they, we see those kinds of documents in the National Archives, in what would be the Department of State or the Treasury Department records. So this is unusual in the sense that this is not a military commission that someone has. This is an actual a federal government position that is being created, given to a man, and Lincoln signs it. That, so that's unusual for us to see.
All right, we're going to come back to the actual content of the order, but Nathan, let's just talk about the condition of this piece of paper. What, describe what did it look like? How does it compare to other documents that your collection has handled over time?
Well, it looks like a document that was used. It's you can see that it's folded twice, and then it was filed. So you see the vestiges of two minor folds, and then it looks like at one point it was framed. Sometimes the small marks on a document tell you something about the journey of the document, what has happened to it in the interim. Overall, the ink is strong. The signature is bold. It's a beautiful piece. It's a beautiful piece.
What do you do to preserve it? I mean, do you have white gloves in your pocket at all times for you never know when something's going to come across you? Or talk about the steps you take.
The white glove myth. So you don't want to handle documents with white gloves except in very, very, very uncommon circumstances. And the reason is because you lose all dexterity. Imagine I told you to handle a piece of paper, but you couldn't damage it. You couldn't nick the corners. You had to be extremely careful in touching it so as not to leave any kind of mark, whether by your own hands or leave behind a piece of a paper towel or a piece of cloth. You would want to use your own fingers because once you introduce the white gloves, you risk accidentally nicking it because you lose that dexterity. So what we do is if a piece requires conservation, we will send it to a conservator, and we have a great conservator who does the work for us. And in most cases, we keep it in an archival sleeve. We keep it away from sunlight, moisture. You know, these documents were signed long before we were born, and they will survive all of us, provided they are well taken care of. And a lot of taken care of documents, there are cases where that's not the case, but a lot of taken care of documents is simple common sense. I mean, you probably don't want to put your paper document above a hot a radiator that's emitting a lot of moisture. I mean, but that's common sense.
And you mentioned that, you know, occasionally you do have forgeries. People try to pass you forgeries. How do you confirm the authenticity of a letter like this?
The way to authenticate a document is not exactly what you think. The best way to authenticate a document is not to look at the signature. It's to look at the document as a whole. It's almost like you're getting the personality of the document. You want to see the context of it. You want to know, was Lincoln in this place at that time? Is the paper the right format? Did he sign the document in the right way? Did he sign this document A. Lincoln or Abraham Lincoln? He used A. Lincoln for letters and Abraham Lincoln for documents. And are the people in the document real people? Is this a published letter? Is this a known document? And in this case, we are eternally grateful for the hard work of the scholars, the very knowledgeable folks at the Papers of Abraham Lincoln, Daniel Worthington, and all the help he and his employees have given us over the years, because they are a great resource for understanding what is out there. Is this a published document? Is the original known? you know, we work with them in a kind of symbiotic relationship where we help them identify the location of these treasures, and they provide us a lot of the background information. And then, of course, you look at the signature. Is the signature the right signature? But it's not. You're not just looking at the signature.
All right, let's talk about the content of the actual document itself, Daniel. It's short. I'm going to read it. It says, Executive Mansion, April 11th, 1865. A.M. Gangewer is hereby appointed to discharge the duties of third auditor of the Treasury during the absence of the auditor caused by sickness or otherwise, Abraham Lincoln. Daniel, who was Allen Gangewer? And correct me if I'm saying that incorrectly.
He was an abolitionist and a newspaper man. He was of German ancestry. He was born in 1818 in Pennsylvania, with German parents. He was apprenticed to become a newspaper printer and publisher. He published and edited newspapers in Pennsylvania, and then he also eventually moved to Ohio, and he became the publisher and editor of an abolitionist newspaper in Columbus, Ohio, and he also became the editor and publisher of the Ohio State Journal, which was the main Republican newspaper in Ohio. He became the personal secretary of Salmon P. Chase, who was the governor of Ohio in 1857 or 1858. And when Chase became the Secretary of Treasury, he brought him to Washington to become part of the Treasury Department. He became a clerk initially. He was a clerk. And then at the time of this document, he was the chief clerk. So he was right beneath the third auditor. The third auditor was in charge of all the invoices that would come in for the subsistence of the army, and including the quartermaster department and other aspects of the army. So that was his important job. So he was set up as basically to be the deputy auditor, which he later became in his career. He ended up staying in the Treasury Department until 1885, and he became a deputy auditor later in his career in the 1870s. The other interesting part about him was he was very active in Washington in providing with the Freedmen's Bureau, with the National Colored School. He helped establish that, the Industrial School of Washington, D.C. So he was very much involved in providing education for African-American children who had been orphaned during the Civil War, contrabands that had been orphaned, and women that had been left behind by their masters, former slaves, enslaved people. So he was a very active person in the abolitionist movement and the free soil movement before that. So he was a very interesting person in those respects.
So he is appointed to discharge the duties of third auditor of the Treasury during the absence of the auditor caused by sickness or otherwise. Daniel, what is happening in America and in American government at this time? Can you remind us? This is right after Appomattox, right?
Yes, it's so April 11th is 2 days after Appomattox. But militarily, things are still happening. There's still fighting in Alabama. The siege of Mobile ends on April 11th. William Sherman is still fighting Joseph E. Johnston in Virginia. He is moving north from North Carolina into Virginia, so he's getting ready to meet up with Grant's army. So Lincoln is still dealing with military aspects. On this very day, Lincoln is working to make sure that the ports of the South are closed so Confederate sympathizers can't escape. He's also working, not only that is happening, but Lincoln is also meeting with his cabinet about the status of the Confederate States, about Reconstruction. And so all through this week, from April 11th all the way through to April 14th, he is having active cabinet meetings. He is, of course, dealing with people who want to fed him and to honor him for Lincoln for Lee's surrender. On April 11th, there's a big, a grand ball at the White House where Lincoln speaks. That's the last speech he delivers. And that's the speech where John Wilkes Booth is in the audience, and Lincoln talks about the future status of the Confederacy and perhaps the possibility that African-American soldiers will get the vote. And that sort of sets off Wilkes Booth to say he has to assassinate Lincoln. So Lincoln is very actively involved in what's going on in that last week. on this particular day, I counted, he gets 75 pieces of correspondence just on this day alone. Many of them require his signature, just like this document. He has several other documents that he has to sign, including some foreign posts that have to be established. So the government is operating and has to operate. The army is still in the field. So Lincoln has to keep, continue to keep the federal bureaucracy going during this time. Even though Lee has surrendered, there's still a lot of things to do.
A lot of things to do, a lot of documents to sign. I once heard somebody say that at least that era of the presidency, so much of it was just about patronage and jobs and managing the flow of papers coming in and out. We're going to continue this conversation about a recently discovered letter at a home in the Midwest for privacy reasons of the person who found it. We're not saying more than that, or I should say the Rab Collection is not saying more than that, and that is the group that has this letter and is actually making it available for sale. We're talking about it with Nathan Rab, who is president of the collection, and Daniel Worthington, director of the Papers of Abraham Lincoln in Springfield. More to come on this here on the 21st Show after a break. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about a document signed by Abraham Lincoln 4 days before his assassination in 1865. It was recently discovered by a woman in the Midwest in her late husband's desk drawer, where it had apparently been locked up for decades. And the letter offers some insight into the president's what he was thinking about, what he was doing in his final days in office. We're talking about this with Nathan Rab, president of the Rab Collection, which is selling the letter, and Daniel Worthington, director of the Papers of Abraham Lincoln at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. You can join us at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. Nathan, we heard some of the story of what this letter represents, who it was about, what Lincoln was doing at the time. How important is having that story to go around a document like this that on its face to the layperson is going to seem pretty obscure? Talk about that in what you do, having that story to go with a letter like this.
Well, the story is everything. It's what gives character to a piece of paper with ink on it. At the end of the day, that's what a document is. The story tells you what's going on in that person's life. In this case, it tells you what's going on in the history of the executive department. I learned a lot from Daniel Worthington just in his life. I mean, what an amazing wealth of knowledge these folks have. Very impressive. It draws you into the piece. It gives it its own personality. So you're not just looking at words on paper and the name Abraham Lincoln. So what we try and do is, our goal is slightly different than the folks of the Papers of Abraham Lincoln. We're looking to find this document and any document that we have its next home. And part of doing that is making sure that the buyer, the prospective buyer, understands exactly what the document is. Who are the people involved in this document? Where has it been? What role did it play in American history? What role did it play in the person who signed it? I mean, to think that Abraham Lincoln was just days away from the end of his life, just a tragic end to one of the iconic American lives. And he was going about his business, running the executive department in this way. It's poignant. There's something tragic about it, but powerful at the same time. So the story is everything.
Daniel, how about that? I mean, this is a man who, I mean, there has been stories that he maybe dreamed of his, you know, demise, but he certainly doesn't know that he has 4 days left. Can you talk about how that colors how we understand and how we think about a document like this?
Certainly. Lincoln, this kind of document is very much what Lincoln is doing all the time as his president. So this is business as usual for him. There's really nothing that he does more than making sure the government runs. And even though Lincoln is involved in what we would consider today to be massive issues of Reconstruction, and he deals with some of the most important documents in American history, the Gettysburg Address and the Emancipation Proclamation, at its basic level, Lincoln is the commander-in-chief, and he's also the head of government. So when Lincoln is signing this document, this is part and parcel of what he does virtually every day of his presidency. He meets with people. He's meeting with people. Even during this week, he's meeting with people who have needs and concerns, and he's making sure that the Army is not going to lose their clothing, their food, in case the third auditor happens to get sick. So that's a big consideration with the Army in the field. So this is the kind of things he does all the time. And we see this every day at the papers of Abraham Lincoln. Some people see these letters as mundane. This is actually what he has to deal with virtually every day of his presidency is with, we don't have, there's a bureaucracy there, but still Lincoln has to sign things and he has to make decisions every day like this. So this is part and parcel of what he does as chief executive.
You know, Daniel, were there any signs that he feared for his safety at this time?
Well, that's a very good question. And the answer would be that Lincoln was very cavalier about his safety. I think Lincoln, from the very beginning, as soon as he was elected in 1860, he started getting letters that threatened his life. And he took a very fatalistic approach to it. He was very reluctant to provide any kind of security for himself. He did allow him to have Pinkerton detectives on his way to Washington, but when he was president, he was determined that the White House would be open and for all citizens to come to see him. He was very determined that he was not going to be like head of states in other places, particularly Europe, kings and monarchs that hid behind walls. Lincoln felt that he was the chief executive. He was the only elected official that everyone could vote on. And so therefore the White House was, in modern day parlance, was wide open. Anyone could come in. Anyone could have an appointment and come in. People did come in. There was very little security. Lincoln was very reluctant to have security. He eventually agreed to have security on his trips out to the old soldier's home, but it was only with great reluctance. He would walk around Washington. He would walk over to the telegraph office at the War Department without an escort. So he took an idea that if he was going to be killed, that he's nothing he could do about it. And he refused to lock himself up behind walls because he felt that was a disservice to the population who had voted for him and elected him. And he should be available for people to come in to petition him for things. And in the very last day, that he's alive, on April 14th, he's talking to the vice president, and an African-American woman comes right up to him and interrupts his conversation to ask him about her husband's back pay. So that's the kind of openness there was then. And I think Lincoln was just open to the possibility he would be killed. He had seen these letters. And eventually he just stopped looking at those letters because there's nothing he can do about them. But we do have most of those letters that were sent to him, and they're terrible letters. But he just simply felt that the chief executive of the United States should not lock himself behind walls away from the people.
Nathan Rabb, I want to ask you, this letter I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, it is for sale, $45,000. That's obviously beyond the reach of most Americans, but I can also understand for somebody of means how, you know, thinking about this piece of paper that Lincoln himself touched, you know, that might seem like a bargain. How do you think about pricing documents like this?
Very good question. Pricing is, generally speaking, an art, not a science. We're dealing with documents for which there are no duplicates. There's no exact other of this document with this exact story. It exists on its own. So it's for us to draw out that story. And generally speaking, the more compelling the story, the more it opens your eyes into the life, personality, character of a person, or reflects on a particular historical event, in this case, the assassination with Lincoln, the more expensive it is, because there's more demand for that. Lincoln signed a lot of things. There's no shortage of documents signed by Lincoln. What determines the high value is the demand, not the supply. Of course, they're rare in the context of our daily lives, But in the grand scheme of things, you know, this isn't a Shakespeare autograph where there are four potentially authentic examples sitting in the British Library. There are many. I mean, I think we have 15 or 20 documents right now signed by Lincoln, the most common being these military commissions that Daniel Worthington alluded to earlier, and the more evocative letters and other documents that are less common. He signed these military commissions, and he signed a lot of them. But the documents that tell you, and those can go anywhere, you know, in the $12,000 to $20,000 range. We consider those among the more affordable documents of Lincoln. Not that they are affordable, they're not. But in the scale of what one can buy, that is generally speaking where those are. And then it goes up from there. You know, you can buy Lincoln documents for tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. And there are a handful that have broken a million. We look at the power of the story, the rarity of the sentiment. In this case, what drove the value is the proximity to the assassination.
I think this is probably the last question, but how do you and your, I don't know if clients is the right term, people who come to you, how do you think about the moral implications of selling a piece of history like this as opposed to donating it to a museum or something like that?
Well, I have a strong opinion on this subject, and I imagine that there are competing opinions, but the United States has a long history of private ownership of historical documents. Some of the great libraries in the country are built on the backs of private ownership. The Morgan Library in New York, the Huntington Library, some of the great documents in institutions right now are there because private citizens bought them from people who did what I do 100 years ago, 50 years ago, and donated them. And some of them are in these institutions because these institutions are also our customers. Our buyers are private citizens, but they're also libraries, governments, universities. I look at it from the perspective of, am I doing a good job advertising what the piece is, putting it out there for the public, notifying folks like the Papers of Abraham Lincoln that such a thing exists so that they understand where it is. And then I hope to find a good buyer, someone who will take care of it and pass it on to the next generation. I think that the line between public institutions and other organizations that are effectively research institutions, which I think is the basis of your question, why doesn't this so to speak belong to the public? The line between that and private ownership is not as thick as people, I think, generally feel.
Nathan Rabb is president of the Rabb Collection, which is selling this letter. Daniel Worthington is director of the Papers of Abraham Lincoln at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Thank you both so much for being with us today on the 21st Show. Fascinating discussion.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks a lot.